Hey, it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Devante Mitchell died outside of a hotel in downtown Milwaukee on June 30th after being held down by four security guards. The minutes leading up to his death were captured by witness videos.
Mitchell's death has brought comparisons to George Floyd, who died in Minneapolis in 2020 after a police officer pinned him down by his neck. Mitchell was black. Members of his family have said they see his death as part of a wider pattern of violence against black people.
Official details are limited. A police report says that the security staff were responding to a disturbance. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office has ruled the preliminary cause of Mitchell's death to be a homicide. In a statement released yesterday, the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office said, quote, "Our office is reviewing Mr. Mitchell's death as a homicide case."
Ambridge Hospitality, operators of the Hyatt Hotel, said in a statement that they had terminated employees involved. The Hyatt chain called for termination and criminal charges. David Clary is a public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been following the story. David, thanks for joining us today.
Hey there. Glad to be here. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak on the story.
Devante Mitchell, his family has told you some about his story, his life. Tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, Devante Mitchell, he was 43. I spoke with his mother outside of the Hyatt Hotel at a demonstration earlier this week. She described him as someone he worked in local restaurants. Most recently, he worked at a Metro Mart grocery store. She's described him as a teddy bear, someone who really enjoyed walking downtown. He found it peaceful. And, you know, a lot of people have described him as a kind, loving member of the family.
A lot of open questions, I think, David, about what happened leading up to Devante Mitchell's death. What do we know?
So we don't know a lot so far on my reporting, but I do know that Attorney Crump and others yesterday, they spoke outside of a court and police building in downtown Milwaukee, and they said they had reviewed footage supplied by the Hyatt that showed certain aspects that hadn't been seen yet by the public. They said it showed him running for safety from someone or something into the women's bathroom. And that was a big sticking point initially, was that Devante Mitchell had been in the women's bathroom for some reason, and that had kind of led to the following dispute with security. But they say that footage shows him running for safety into the bathroom. It shows him later with his hands up and then being dragged to the floor and beaten with a retractable baton by security. And that's footage that the attorneys spoke about yesterday.
And I mentioned your reporting just out on the response from the operating company for the hotel and for Hyatt itself. What have we heard about them, about the staff and their reactions?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, Ambridge Hospitality, they're the third party operator for the hotel. They released a statement late last night saying they had fired the workers. That came following what they described as a review of the incident, and they decided it violated company policies and procedures and said it didn't reflect their values. It did follow a earlier in the day statement by Hyatt calling for criminal charges and for the workers to be terminated. It's not clear yet exactly which workers, is it just the security guards? Witnesses have said there was another staffer on site at the time, too, speaking with them and things of that nature. So it's not entirely clear at this time which employees were fired, but they said the associates involved in the incident were terminated. And so that's kind of what we know there.
And David, for as far as official response from a coroner, a police, district attorney, terse, I think it's fair to say the statements we've heard so far. What have you been able to piece together?
Yeah, a lot of what you talked about at the top here is what we know so far. You know, the DA's office is investigating the death as a homicide, but they said they're awaiting the medical examiner's full autopsy before they determine on criminal charges. The police have said that, you know, it's an ongoing investigation, and they haven't commented much on that. Yesterday at a press conference, Milwaukee Police Department Chief Jeff Norman, he was asked about the case, and he spoke about it a little bit, you know, somewhat tongue in cheek, you know, said if it's not a criminal case, then why is the DA's office investigating it? But really, again, the police's line has been, it's an ongoing investigation at this time, you know, and so they don't say much at this time.
What are you watching for now, David, as you continue to follow this story?
On my end, I'm curious to see, you know, obviously what happens in regards to criminal charges, and would love to review any footage from inside the hotel, because again, that's footage that I believe Attorney Crump and the rest of the family's attorneys have reviewed, but from what I have seen and in my reporting have not been able to review, you know, the inside the hotel lobby footage. And so those, I think, are the two main points at this time.
And finally, David, as often happens, there is some witness video in the last minutes of Devante Mitchell's life. What do we see in those videos? What don't they tell us?
Yeah, you know, it's and this is where the George Floyd comparisons come in, right? You know, you can see Devante Mitchell held face down by security guards. It's in the video I reviewed, it's somewhat difficult exactly to tell, you know, the exact placement of like knees and things like that. But witnesses have told me they were on his back, you know, like knees were putting pressure on his back, and you can hear screaming and you can hear, you know, cries calling out and things of that nature. And it's a difficult video to watch. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of what we see at this time. And I think that's obviously why it's invoked those George Floyd comparisons.
David, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
David Clary is a breaking news and turning and a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us about his reporting on Devante Mitchell, who died on June 30th after being held down by security outside the Hyatt Regency in downtown Milwaukee. Now we turn to one of the attorneys representing Devante Mitchell's family. Ben Crump is a trial lawyer who specializes in civil rights cases. He's represented many Black families whose loved ones were killed or injured in high-profile incidents, including the families of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and Jacob Blake. Ben, thanks for joining us today. Do we have Ben Crump? Okay, Ben, can you hear me?
I'm here, yes.
Wonderful.
I can hear you.
Thank you for...
I apologize. I'm in the district attorney's office, but you have me now.
Thank you for joining us in the middle of work. It sounds like you've said, yes. You and the family have said that Devante Mitchell was facing a mental health crisis the day he died. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, his family talks about how he dealt with depression after his father died in 2016, how he actually wanted counseling for dealing with these thoughts he was having. But I will tell you, after looking at the video, it's apparent Devante was running for his life. And when you see the just brutality in the video, it's troubling on many levels. And so we believe charges are warranted, and we think it's wholly appropriate that the Hyatt and the franchise owner terminated the employees based on what we see on this video.
You are working with Devante Mitchell's family. You mentioned you're hoping for charges. Talk through what you're hoping to hear from the DA and when you're hoping to hear from them.
We think that there's enough there now to bring charges. They say they're waiting on the completion of the autopsy report. And the only thing that I respond to that with is, it's not the same when the roles are reversed. And it's been Devante Mitchell who did this to the security guard. Nobody would be waiting on the autopsy. He would have been arrested, charged, and sitting in a jail cell. So what we ask for in our community is just equal justice. We want the rules to be the same. You want due process. You don't want it to be two systems of justice. So those are the things we grapple with. The thing that I am appreciative of is at least we got to review the videos many times. You know, they continue to hide behind this bait and switch, where they say, oh, it's a pending investigation and you can never see the video until it's like 2 years later and everybody has forgot about the unarmed dead Black man saved his family. So we feel grateful that we at least see the video now. We at least see the truth of what happened with our own eyes.
you said in Milwaukee earlier this week that police officers and security workers should have learned not to hold people down or keep them in prone positions after the death of George Floyd. Can you talk about that comparison with George Floyd's and lessons you're hoping people learn from this?
Yeah, you know, America, how many more black men have to die in prone positions with knees on their neck and knees on their back? I mean, we saw it, obviously, with George Floyd and then Ivo Otenio in Virginia and then Frank Tyson in Ohio. And now we're here with Devontae Mitchell in the prone position, knee on his neck, knee on his back. George Floyd was 9 minutes and 29 seconds. We don't know exactly the time. We're still trying to figure it out, but we believe Devontae was at least 8 minutes, could have been as much as 10 minutes while he's down there in the prone position, having problems breathing, and they continue to not show him 1 ounce of humanity and just keep him there until the point where they realize he's completely unconscious. And then you see them having concern, but it's troubling, so troubling when you see the inhumanity, the brutality, I mean, the excessive use of force, and you ask yourself why.
Ben, in just our last few moments, it's up to the DA to file criminal charges. Working with the family, are they thinking about filing civil charges?
Absolutely. We want full justice. Black people are tired of getting partial justice that you can't have criminal culpability and civil accountability. No, the Seventh Amendment applies to us too in civil cases. And obviously, when you have a homicide and it's not justified, we expect that people to be held accountable for killing us too, just like they try to always charge people in our community with the most serious of the charges. And we just say equal justice, nothing more, nothing less.
Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. God bless.
That's Attorney Ben Crump joining us from the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office. Crump is representing the family of Devontae Mitchell.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new dairy research complex is planned for Prairie du Sac with studies on artificial intelligence and herd management.
AI is really something that I think is going to make the hand of the farmer to be more precise.
New robotic capabilities on the farm, that's ahead on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When the Republican National Convention kicks off in Milwaukee next week, it'll shine a spotlight on the city, not to mention its Democratic mayor.
Cavalier Johnson was instrumental in helping to land the RNC. As Sean Johnson reports, it's been part of a busy 2 years for the young mayor, who's known he wanted to work in politics since he was a kid.
Cavalier Johnson was born and raised in Milwaukee, one of 10 siblings. He says he remembers growing up what it was like to see violence, to be hungry, to have the energy shut off when it was cold.
I wanted to do things differently than what I saw. Like, I wanted more for myself, for my neighborhood, for my family and future family, and really for my city.
Johnson decided to apply himself. He joined a YMCA program and started volunteering in the community. One day, very suddenly, he realized how he could do more. It happened after the September 11th attacks, when former President George W. Bush gave a speech at Ground Zero. In Bush, Johnson saw someone trying to bring people together.
For whatever reason, it just clicked in my head, right? I could go into government and have a career like the president, where I help people like I fell in love with doing at the YMCA. And I just was off to the races from there. So I've been focused on this since I was a 14-year-old kid.
Even though he's a Democrat, Johnson still counts the Republican, Bush, among his political heroes, alongside former President Barack Obama and the Reverend Martin Luther King. It's an unlikely trio, but Johnson's abrupt rise to power in city politics has been anything but ordinary. Victor Amaya knew Johnson, the teenager. He was his mentor in Johnson's YMCA program. Amaya says that even back then, people would hear Johnson talk and say he should be in politics. But he says Johnson has always stayed genuine.
I don't think he takes relationships as transactional, right? I've never felt and I've never seen him take on something just because it's going to benefit him.
While Johnson knew early on where he wanted to go, actually winning elections proved hard. He ran his first campaign in 2011 for Milwaukee County Board and placed a distant fifth in a five-person race. The candidate who won that race, Ian Biddle, remembers Johnson being courteous, smart, passionate, and young.
Very young. No facial hair.
Johnson lost another county board race the next year, but he stayed involved, got a job in city government, moved to a neighborhood he knew, and in 2016, he ran for city council. By then, Biddle says Johnson knew what it took to win, and he was relentless.
Look, man, he's a driven individual because his first two races did not go well. And most people just would have tucked their tails and ran, you know, but he kept fighting and working for what he wanted, for the vision that he saw for himself. And you can't take that away from him.
By 2020, Johnson won a tight race to be president of the Common Council. In 2022, he became the city's first ever elected Black mayor. That year, he visited Washington to make a pitch to bring the RNC to Milwaukee, and he was soon visiting Madison to ask support for a new Milwaukee sales tax to prevent massive layoffs, even bankruptcy. Johnson says his first call as mayor was to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the powerful Republican with a long record of blocking Democratic policies. But when Johnson made his pitch, Voss says he listened.
While we don't agree on every political issue, I think he's trustworthy. And I think he was genuine in his attempt to try to say what's possible, as opposed to saying, this is what I want. And when you don't hear what you want, you walk away.
When Johnson's asked what's next for him and whether he'd consider running for governor someday, he points out that he was only 35 when he was elected mayor.
So I've got a long future ahead of me. And I think there will be opportunities for me to explore other options in the future. Would I be interested in running for governor one day? Absolutely. Absolutely, I would.
Johnson would have his work cut out if he ever ran statewide, given the city of Milwaukee's ongoing struggles with crime and education. But if he has any self-doubt, Johnson doesn't show it. He says that ambitious 14-year-old kid is still inside of him. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
A new hub for dairy research is moving ahead in Wisconsin.
The $55 million project is slated for Prairie du Sac in the south central part of the state. It will include 18 buildings. It aims to modernize dairy research with studies in robotics, artificial intelligence, and herd nutrition, and new ways to streamline dairy farm operations.
To learn more about the latest developments and technology advances in the dairy industry, we have Dennis Hancock, the director of the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center, which is housed at UW-Madison. Dennis, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate being here.
Dairy farms are in decline. Wisconsin lost roughly 30% of its dairy farms during a five-year period starting in 2017. That's from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Census of Agriculture. Why open a new research center now?
Well, in hopes of actually staving off some of those departures, we have seen a large decrease in the number of dairies over the past several decades, actually, but it's increasingly at a higher rate. Tremendous amount of consolidation going on across the country, and that's a big part of it. And frankly, a lot of these farm operations are struggling on a variety of levels, not the least of which is labor. And that's one of the areas in which we're really trying to develop some solutions and help with that problem.
What might be a potential solution to the issue of not enough people being able to run this dairy operation?
Well, it sounds counterintuitive, but actually one of the ways to save smaller farms, in my opinion, and those that have actually made the conversion would agree, is through the use of robotics. Robotics are quite expensive, but they do save a lot of labor, and they can really help free up labor in many cases to do other chores, or in some cases even to have off-farm employment. You know, many of our farms, about 95% or so or more, are family-owned farm operations. And so the key for them is trying to make that labor work with the family resources that they have, as well as maybe a few other employees and whatnot that may have available to them. And often that goes at the consequence of their own family activities. And it's a 24/7, 365 type of job. And coming up with solutions that add some flexibility, like robotics, will really help in the long run, we believe.
So in terms of robotic milkers, where does the automation begin in the milking process and where does it end?
So the automated milking systems are one portion of the robotic solution, and that's the most noteworthy, of course. That's the biggest labor savings. And there's a couple different designs, really, that go along with that. One is what's known as free flow, which basically the cows decide when they are ready to be milked. And once trained, they'll decide, you know, 3, 4, maybe even 6 times a day to come in and be milked. And as they get further into their lactation cycle, they may slow down to 2 or maybe even 1 eventually. In the guided flow system, there's more constraints put on that. They limit the number of visits, or they try to encourage them to visit the parlor, or, you know, before getting milked or getting feed, or vice versa, go to the feed bunk before getting milked. So there's some really interesting dynamics to that. And one of the aspects of our new research dairy is that we'll be able to actually compare and contrast those systems, the free flow versus the guided flow
system. The scheduled system versus mm-hmm. allowing the cow to direct when they want to be milked.
Exactly, exactly.
So Hord's Dairyman, the Dairy Farm magazine, writes that the cost of one system is between $150,000 to $275,000. Are these robotic milking machines cost prohibitive for small farms?
They are quite expensive. There's no argument there. However, with labor is certainly not cheap these days either. And when you look at this over the lifespan of one of these machines, many of the smaller dairies that we've talked with that have made that conversion said for them it was a no-brainer. They really had no other choice in many cases. Of course, robotics is not just limited to the automated milking systems. There are other techniques, other systems. For example, currently at our farm, we have a small robot that does push-ups. It goes along in front of the bunk and pushes the feed up closer.
Ah.
You know, cows are active, and they will use their tongues, and they'll flop the feed away from them, and they use this robot to push it back up. And that's a standard practice in many dairies anyway, but it's usually done either by hand or on a skid steer or something like that. And this is a labor savings for us to be able to provide that. So,
how much of a role will artificial intelligence have in dairy technology and as your research advances?
Well, that's a chapter that's still being written at the moment. I think we're really just at the introduction to that chapter, honestly. But the way I view it, and I think many others do, is particularly through the feed. We have a feed that can be fed in the bunker, of course, where they're close to their bed, so to speak, and then also in the robot. So we can feed a diet or a small enticement in their diet in the robot to entice them to come to the robot more often. But we can also very prescriptively combine ingredients in that robot for that particular cow. Historically, we do feeding in groups or herds, and sometimes it's the whole herd gets the same ration. But in many dairies now, they segment that into different phases of their life and where they're at, whether it's the first cow, you know, first calf cow, or one that's later in her life, where she's at in her lactation cycle, et cetera. Now we can get it down to the individual cow. And we can also begin to detect if there's issues in the milk or if there's issues with their behavior, their activity.
the computer can automatically flag it and say something is a challenge for this animal. Can we figure out what may be going on? So AI is really something that I think is going to make that the hand of the farmer to be more precise, more attuned, even as their operation may be getting larger, the larger number of cows, they'll still be able to have that one-on-one type of approach to their cows and ensuring their well-being and cared for.
We're talking about research innovations in the dairy industry with Dennis Hancock, who is Center Director at the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center. That center is based at UW-Madison. Dennis, as the research focuses on farm efficiencies and you know, labor shortages, and you're looking at bigger issues around climate change and how farms fit into that piece, the new center is expected to have a full unit of study devoted to environmentally integrated management. What does that mean? Why is it important?
So we currently have a research unit called the Environmentally Integrated Dairy Management Research Unit that's based in Marshfield, actually, about 2.5 hours north of us. And they really focus on the environmental footprint of the dairy industry. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, nutrient loss and the use of nitrogen and phosphorus in various forms, including manure, of course, onto these fields and the escape of those nutrients into the environment, particularly impacting our water quality, both surface waters and groundwaters. In addition, we have a whole team there looking at pathogens and the risk of some of those pathogens from either the dairy industry or also other livestock sectors, and oh, by the way, ourselves as humans with some of our rural septic systems. We have techniques to actually be able to identify if that pathogen came from a cow or if it came from a human. So to try to come up with ways in which we can scout out where some of those wells need to be to avoid the risks associated with disease. Another major area that we're focused, and this will be a new investment with the new dairy, is we're looking at methane emissions. Now, we're already doing a lot of work with methane emissions, but in the new research dairy, we will have chambers in which we will be able to really do a thorough job of understanding how much methane is coming out in a whole day cycle.
On that issue of methane, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, says anaerobic digesters have been increasing in popularity since 2000. As manure decomposes, these digesters can create that energy from the biogas produced. Do you envision further research into these biodigesters?
So there's a number of ARS researchers across the country who are working with that at this point. Our dairy will be relatively small to be able to make that cost effective. Our dairy will only be milking 360 cows, which is right-sized for our research. But to really make that viable, it needs to be about 3,000 cows in order to make the economics really pencil out without any other sort of incentives or anything like that.
What are good strategies to reduce environmental damage from manure? What are you looking at?
So one of the key things that we've been looking at there is to ensure we get incorporation with manure. Historically, and the way that I grew up spreading cow manure was basically just surface applications. And for many instances, that's fine. But in general, it's better if we can incorporate that into the soil with minimal disturbance. Now, we don't really want to really plow the land either and to turn it in. What we want to do is just to inject that into the soil surface just a few inches deep. And, you know, even with perennial crops, things that are going to come back year after year after year, like alfalfa, for example, we are looking at ways in which we can do that with minimal damage to the crop stand.
So with these chambers, and you said that you're expecting them to be quite popular, to get a lot of use. How will they work, and how can you measure greenhouse gas emissions?
So the animal actually will be enclosed in this chamber. They'll have actually glass enclosures, not too dissimilar to an interview studio, where one can see who's beside them and so forth.
There actually be some other engagement items in there to kind of get the cow's attention. And they'll be in there for about a week. They will come out for milking, but they will be fed in there. They will be provided water. We'll measure everything going in and coming out, both liquid and otherwise, as well as gaseous emissions. And we'll be able to look at a lot of different gases that will be coming out, not just methane, which is a key one, but we'll be looking at carbon dioxide, oxygen, even looking at the metabolic activity of the animal. So we'll be able to look at a variety of different gaseous emissions there. So usually it will be to test a different type of feed or some different type of feeding system. We have a number of those that are in the works right now that we have other types of systems to be able to get a sense of it. But those are usually just snapshots in time and not throughout the entire day-long or week-long life of that animal.
So, you will have so much more data to work with.
A tremendous amount of data, not only looking at total emissions, of course, and dividing that by the day, but also looking at, you know, when the animal's laying down, what does that mean? When she's standing up, if she's drinking more, is that having the impact on her methane output that she has? And, of course, any diets that we might impose. And there are a huge number of candidate additives or changes that we can administer to the diet that we can determine whether or not those are going to be effectual or not. There are a number of chemicals, for example, one that's recently coming on the market. It's being used in Europe already, but hopefully will be used in the U.S. soon. And there's even things like seaweed, for example, that is being evaluated for its opportunities for reducing methane emissions.
Dennis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
That is Dennis Hancock, who is Center Director at the U.S. Dairy Forage Research Center. He's based at UW-Madison.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, find out why a Swedish lawn game has a national championship coming up in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's the heartbeat of this game, and Eau Claire is just like the Mecca. It's the pilgrimage.
The game is called Coob. Find out more up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you ever heard of Coob? It is a Swedish lawn game that has taken Wisconsin by storm. And in fact, the Coob capital of North America is right here in Eau Claire.
Eric Anderson is director of the U.S. National Coob Championship in Eau Claire, the oldest and largest Coob tournament outside of Europe. Eric, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on. This is great.
I want to hear your origin story, Eric. How did you first learn about Coob and get started playing?
Yeah, so the first time that I ever played Coob was in 2002, took a trip to Sweden. My wife and I went there visiting some friends, played a couple times, I think, late into the night when we were there, did a graduate program in Sweden. So played there a couple times during that school year. And then on Midsummer Day and Midsummer Eve in Sweden, we went to our friend's parents' house in this orchard overlooking this lake with this forest and everything. And we just played Coob all afternoon and all night and just 100% fell in love with it. And then when we moved back to the States about a month later, my dad had a Coob set waiting for us. So that was our very first own Coob set when we moved back to the States in 2006.
So it's one thing to get your own set and play. It's another thing to start a tournament. What led to the creation of the big championship in Eau Claire?
Yeah, so we moved to Eau Claire in January of 2007. Moved here sight unseen. People laugh when I didn't really even know how to say Eau Claire, but we moved here sight unseen. Didn't have a car, didn't have a whole lot, but we had one Coob set. Just loved it. And I've had this idea to start a tournament. for Coob, and I found out that there was no other tournaments in the U.S., so I wanted to start the first tournament. At the same time, my mind couldn't stop thinking about the atrocities at the time that were happening in Darfur, Sudan. So I wanted to bring awareness to what was happening there. And so the idea was to that summer to host a Coob tournament, raise some money for the awareness of what was happening in Darfur, and to host that tournament. And that year here in Eau Claire, we had 15 teams, about 32, 33 players. Probably about a third of them were friends and family that came up from Rockford, and the tournament just exploded after that.
Yeah, 15 teams then. How many teams are scheduled for this year's tournament?
So that first year, the minimum was two-person teams. So people could have two people on a team, three people on a team. So that year we had 15 teams. This year we have 144 teams, and the minimum number of players is three, and we average about 3.5 people per team. So it is just exploded since 2007.
How far and away are people coming from to be in the tournament nowadays?
So every year we get players from coast to coast. So this year we have a new team coming from Tacoma, Washington. We get a team coming from California every year. We get other teams coming from the West Coast. We get teams coming from all different parts of the East Coast. We have three or four new teams this year coming from Texas. And this year, one of the top players in Europe is actually coming over from Belgium to play. So it seems like every year we get one or two of the top European players to make the trip to play on a team over here as well. So this year we have 25 states represented here at the championship this year.
Now this game, it's from Sweden originally. Do you ever get people from Sweden coming to play, or at least spectate?
Yep. So both. We've had a couple players from Sweden come and play. And that's been awesome. So much fun. This year we have a gentleman coming from Sweden. He lives on Gotland, where the World Championships were started and where the World Championships are hosted. He runs a lot of Coob events and tournaments there, has his own team. He's coming over this year just to experience it. He's not playing in it. He just wants to meet people. He wants to see how we operate and, you know, how we do things with our tournament. And he just wants to help out and just kind of meet as many people as he can.
Can you talk about Coob in Sweden? You were there. That's where you learned it. How big a deal is the game there?
Yeah, it's huge. So Coob is pretty much their lawn game, right? So we in America here, we have maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different types of lawn games that we play. In Sweden, it'd be hard to find somebody that doesn't know what Coob is, right? So it's huge. The World Championships, I think this year might be year round 30 for the World Championships, which is held on Gotland every year. Yeah. It'd be really tough to find somebody in Sweden that didn't know what Coob is.
And I've heard Eau Claire now described as the Coob capital of North America. I mean, is your event the big Coob event of the year here?
Yeah, so this is the big one. So I would say the next largest tournament in America is maybe half the size of the U.S. championship here. In 2011, I went to the city manager, asked the city manager at the time if we could be the Coob capital of America. I couldn't believe that I could meet with him and ask him that, you know, in the first place, but he looked at me, laughed, shook his head no, and he goes, "How about the Coob Capital of North America?" And I said, "I like that." So we went to the city council. They passed a resolution in 2011 that we were officially the Coob Capital of North America. We have the world's largest weekly Coob League here in Eau Claire. They do that in the winter, fall, and spring. We have several tournaments here in Eau Claire. We have Kid Coob, which is the day before the U.S. championship, and that's the U.S. junior championship. And then the U.S. championship that's the big one. That's the one where people come from all across the country to play.
Now, speaking of kids, I have friends who grew up in some central Wisconsin communities who said that, you know, they had a PE requirement and they could do it with a bowling class. Anything like that for Coob in the Eau Claire area?
Oh, absolutely. I think pretty much every school in the school district has Coob sets. So we have a Coob set program. As I mentioned, my dad gave us that first Coob set. We have a program that's named after him. He passed away about 10 years ago or so, and we named it after him, but it's called the Steve Anderson Coob set program. And so we've given away well over 100 free sets over the past 10, 12 years. A lot of them are to schools throughout the country. From coast to coast, we've given out free Coob sets. And pretty much every single school in Eau Claire has Coob sets, and it's common to see it in the PE classes here in Eau Claire.
We're talking about Kub, a Swedish lawn game that has a lot of fans here in Wisconsin. Eric Anderson, foremost among them, one of the co-founders of the U.S. National Kub Championship in Eau Claire. Eric, we gave just a little taste of what the game is. Talk us through now. If we're playing Kub, what are we doing? What's happening on the field? Pitch? What do we call it?
You can call it whatever you want, but we call it a pitch. But it's there's two teams, so it's kind of tough to explain. But there's two teams. There's five cubes, and those are the wooden blocks. Those are on each side of the pitch. There's the king in the middle. And the goal of the game is to throw six batons from one side of the pitch to the other side of the pitch. So the one team throws their six batons and tries to knock over the cubes on your opponent's side. And the king, he's like the eight ball. So if you knock him over during the game, you lose. It's a game of skill, strategy, and maybe a little bit of luck. But what you need to do is you need to knock over those cubes on your opponent's baseline. They then throw those cubes into your half of the field. You raise them vertical, and then they have to knock over those field cubes, called field cubes, before they can knock over your baseline cubes. So there's different strategies in where you throw those cubes. When you throw them across to your opponent's side, you want to get them as close together as you can. The one big caveat of the game that keeps every team alive, even if you're down, let's say, 5-0, is that if you don't clear your field cubes in the field, your opponents get to move up to the cube that's closest to that mid-pitch line, and they can advance to that line and then throw their batons from there. So
a shorter throw.
A much shorter throw. So there's a lot of different strategies in how you throw the batons, how you throw the cubes, what order your teammates go. Like I said, here at the championship, the minimum number of players on the team is three. A lot of times for bigger tournaments like this that require three or more players, each player will have a specialty that they'll throw. Maybe the short ones, maybe the long ones, maybe trying to blast a large group of cubes that are in the field. So there's a lot of different strategy involved.
Now, we tried it out on Wisconsin Today last week, and I had seen Kub played before, but I obviously didn't look close enough. Now, I feel like I had a lot of shots where I was so close, or mm-hmm. the baton would do this magical dance up over and around the Kub at the other end. I mean, there's a lot of heartbreaking moments like that, I assume.
There are a lot of heartbreaking moments like that in every game. Like every game, you see something and you think to yourself, how did that Kub not go down? Or maybe you see it on your opponent and you think to yourself, how did that Kub go down? You know, there's a saying that the more that you practice, the luckier that you get. But
fair.
There is some luck involved as well.
Now, it's a long game if people are just playing in their backyard or at the park or whatever. You can kind of walk it off, ballpark the dimensions of the pitch. How precise are you, though, at the tournament level? Are you trying to get really according to regulations here?
Oh, it's 8x5. Yep. So 8 meters long by 5 meters wide. The mid pitch is 4 meters. So we measure that exactly a couple days before the championship. And then we measure it again on Sunday when the top 16 teams come back. So we get it down to exactly the 5 meters by 8 meters. But I'd really recommend if somebody's out there and they, you know, go by a set or they play for the first time, you don't need to play 8 meters. You can play at 6 meters. You can play at 7 meters, whatever distance you feel comfortable enough where you're, you know, able to knock stuff down. Because that's what makes it fun, is being able to obviously hit the cubes and knock them down.
Now, you're organizing the tournament, obviously. Do you get to play?
No, never have. I've never played in the championship. It's too much work.
A bit conflict of interest too, I guess.
Yeah. And that first year when we hosted it, I was just trying to run it. I brought my grill. I had brats, I had burgers, and it was the food was burning. It was just a mess. So I quickly realized that we need to have somebody come and serve food. We actually have girls in the run. They come and serve food for us, and we're a fundraiser for them as well. So we raise money for Girls in the Run. We have this special, we call it a Swedish brat. And so, and I know lefse isn't Swedish. I know it's Norwegian, but we take a brat and we wrap it in lefse with some honey mustard in there, fresh dill. And then, you know, like those fried onions that we put on top of casserole and everything.
Totally.
So we put that in there, and then they sell those Swedish brats, and they sell hundreds of them, probably like 500 of them each year here at the championship.
Why do you think Kub has caught on so well? I mean, you and a few other people have really made Kub a thing here in the state.
Yeah, it's an awesome game. I mean, it really is. And I think this weekend at the pre-championship, there was an instance where there was this three-generation family. It was grandpa, son, and granddaughter, and they were playing together. It's just this three-generation. You can play it with your family. You can play it with different generations, and they're so happy. And this game really is open to all ages, all skill levels. It's a friendly environment. The people are great. And you don't have to be like the biggest and strongest, you know, person to be really good at it. You know, there's obviously concentration, there's practice, there's those types of things in regards to, you know, trying to get good at it. But the entry level to get into the game is just, you know, just getting out there and wanting to try something new. And, you know, you're outside, you're enjoying the company of other people. It's just a fun game to play.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
This is awesome. Thank you so much.
That was Eric Anderson, director and co-founder of the U.S. National Coob Championship in Eau Claire. That's taking place this weekend.
Now, Rob and I recently had a chance to learn the rules of Coob and try out a game of our own.
And there's some audio to prove it. Here's producer Mackenzie Crummy.
Recently, on a warm June afternoon, Rochelle Wilson, a producer on Wisconsin Today, challenged hosts Rob Ferret and Kate Archer-Kent to a round of the Swedish game known as Coob.
No, this is the debut Coob Classic Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Coob Day.
That international.
It was Coobson today. There, yeah. That's the thing.
We've been training for months.
On the UW-Madison campus, Rochelle sets up the pitch, she outlines the rules, and gives a little background.
The best urban legend is that this was a game that the Vikings used to play with the skulls and bones of their enemies. Today, we're not going to ask Rob and Kate to make such a sacrifice.
Kate is on a team with Jonah Balekis, digital content producer for Wisconsin Today. And Rob is on a team with Beatrice Lawrence, a producer from the same show. Here's how the first few rounds go.
Oh, well, that's a little long. Let's see what Beatrice can do on the second shot. Still a little long. Oh.
I see why the Swedes call this the most dangerous game. Oh, actually, that was kind of dangerous.
Sorry, Beatrice. That's okay. I'm good.
After a few rounds of each team throwing their coobs, we get some spectators.
So we're teaching the hosts here to play a game called Coob. Have you ever heard of it?
No, we haven't. That's why we saw it. We walked over.
Then an audience member sealed the fate of the game.
Who are you betting on? Who do you think's going to win?
I'm going to go with Blue Blouse.
Yes, Kate Archer-Kent there. She is. She's fierce, isn't she?
Yeah.
And it was all downhill from there.
So what do we got going on here? Who's got what points?
Oh, they've got one more to knock down. We have not hit one yet, except the special ones in the middle.
For the next 30-some minutes, Kate and Jonah knocked down Coob.
Oh, that was nice. Oh, yeah.
After Coob. Until finally the last round with Jonah and Kate.
Oh yeah. Did that happen? Did we just win? Coob champion of WPR. I mean
I've been dreaming of this since I was 5 years old, about 60 years ago.
I want to thank all the supporters who made
this
possible.
All of my teachers who said that I couldn't do this. I mean, they said this guy's going nowhere, and now look at me. I mean.
You can read more about Coob and our experience with it at WPR.org. By the way, I did eventually knock down a couple Coob.
I'll challenge you to a game any day, Rob.
You'll probably win. A while back, we asked for some feedback from you. Quick Trip introduced a donut-flavored potato chip. We wanted to hear your thoughts on combining sweet and salty and your favorite chip flavors.
Marianne in Madison emails, for that sweet-salty combo, there's nothing more inviting than the recipe for potato chip cookies that you'll find in the Old Farm Country Cookbook by Jerry Apps and Susan Apps Bodily.
And for great chip flavors in general, Dwayne in Westfield says he found perfection in a flavor that was only available for a year or two.
And he can't find it anymore. It's from Old Dutch. It was the pulled pork barbecue. That is like the ultimate in chips. You taste the actual pulled pork so well that you don't even pay attention. You're eating chips.
Keep sharing your thoughts. Call or text us now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Pulled pork chips and all, or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.